Steve Scheinken is a Newbery Award-winning children's author who made annual visits to schools to meet and read with students. When the pandemic forced him to cancel his usual travel plans last year, he wanted to find another way to continue to interact with his readers. That's when he teamed up with Stacy Ratner, an elementary school librarian in Castleton, New York. They'd been friends for years, and together they came up with a fun way to get students and authors together. It's called the Author Fan Face-Off, a game show available on YouTube. Here's how the first episode sounded.
But let's just jump right in. This is the very first episode of the Author Fan Face-Off, and the idea is very simple. In theory, it's just one writer, one student, one book by that writer, and they go head-to-head, see who knows more about it. I'm Steve Scheinken, and I'm going to co-host this show with, you know her as the leaping librarian from Castleton Elementary in upstate New York, Stacy Ratner.
Hello.
And, of course, you know our special guest, our author. We have two special guests, but our author special guest, Chris Grabenstein.
Hey, great to be here, Steve, for this initial round. I was reading it.
Since that first episode, there have been over two dozen segments of the Face-Off produced and released to the public. Steve Scheinken and Stacy Ratner spoke with the best of our knowledge's Bob Barrett about this project and their partnership.
At least my end of it, I really started with the pandemic. This is very 2020. I mean, this whole idea is very much of its time. When it hit and school closed last year, everyone in my world, the author, the children's book author world, scrambled to try to do something constructive, reading chapters aloud on Zoom, doing online things. And so I spent some time trying to think about what we could do, what I could do that would be helpful and a little bit different, and came up with the idea of somehow interacting with popular authors in a way that kids could play along. But it was only in conversations with Stacy, whose school I visited as an author and visited her students. And we started chatting. She's one of the first people I talked to. I said, what do you think of this idea? What could we do? And it was only in the conversation that we came up with the game show format with the kid involved in this kind of live, exciting environment where the kid is actually challenging one of their favorite authors about one of these great books.
Right. I mean, Steve emailed me, I think it was very brief, maybe one or two sentences back in early August, and said, I have this idea. Can you want to talk about it? And I'd like to run it by you. So, you know, we talked on the phone, and then that just that one conversation just evolved into the show. I think we were just like, let's just try this. And I have access to students and people across the country, as does Steve. And it just really like took off. I mean, I was thrilled, honored that Steve reached out to me first. And I love the partnership. I love the show. I love everything about it.
How did you start getting the students involved?
Steve had said, let's do, he had already reached out to Chris Grabenstein as our first for our pilot. And I reached out to some of my students and said, does anybody, I mean, this was still like late summer. We hadn't even started school yet. And does anybody want to be involved? And we got one of my students. And so he was the first one. All right, Ace, what do the winners of Mr. Lemoncello's essay contest win?
A lock-in at the library before anyone else gets to go in.
I'll take that. Yeah. Chris. If you remember my Halloween costume, name the head librarian of the new Alexandriaville Public Library.
That would be Dr. Yanina Zinchenko, who is named after Dr. Yanina Zinchenko, who is a librarian in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, who was one of the librarians who helped me when I was writing the book.
All right, this is tough.
Fun fact.
These guys both know what they're doing here.
I know.
I'm going to go back to Ace. Mr. Lemoncello's library is in a building that used to be what type of business?
It used to be the Gold Leaf Bank. It used to be a bank.
Wow.
That is correct.
I'm picking bank, but yeah, Gold Leaf.
That's good.
I know.
This one's tough. I think this is hard. All right. Mr. Lemoncello's car, Chris. His car looks like what article of clothing?
It looks like a boot, because like Ace, I used to love playing Monopoly, and there's a game piece there that's a shoe, so I made a boot And that's one of the game pieces in his game, Family Frenzy, and he drives around in a bootmobile.
Steve, are these authors that you already had a relationship with?
That's where we started. And yes, for the most part, I mean, that is the one thing about, well, maybe every professional world gets kind of small when you're in it. And so with children's book authors, we all see each other. I mean, in a normal year, we would see each other throughout the year at different events, book fairs, conferences, things like that. And so, yeah, I'm lucky I have all these contacts. And I thought that would be kind of the easy part, I think, getting authors who are very generous to just give 15 minutes of their time to do this. Actually, the hard part, I thought, might be that the authors would be reluctant because they don't want to lose necessarily, be recorded losing to a kid in a challenge about their own book. And I was a little worried that they would be reluctant for that reason. And it just hasn't been true. I mean, authors have lost terribly. Even some famous authors have lost on, you know, award-winning books where they've just been crushed by their reader. But they take it well. They take it as a compliment, which I think it really is.
I was going to ask one of the questions I wrote down. How many times have you stumped the author on their own book?
Oh, many times. Yeah, some of our favorite episodes. There's one with Catherine Applegate, who wrote The One and Only Ivan, a hugely popular book. It's been made into a movie. And this kid just knew it way better than Catherine did. And that made it actually, it could be awkward, but it wasn't. And it never seems to be. It's just, it actually made it more fun.
Did it start out, Stacy, with just students that you knew? And after that, how did you begin widening it out? How are you choosing these students to participate?
I think it started out, maybe the first few were students from my school and from my district, but then there's Facebook pages of future ready librarians there. I have colleagues that I have met over the years from national and state conferences. So I just put feelers out and I would just send emails out and say, do you have a student? In the beginning, we were picking the authors first. And then, you know, would you be able to pair this student? Do you have a student who's a fan of this author? I think now sometimes we have the students have requested, oh, this is my favorite author. Do you think that you could get this author? And we've been able to do that. So, and Steve had some connections too from some book camps that he has been involved with. So we've both gotten students and we have both reached out to authors as well. I have a lot of authors that I've connected with by school visits and at conferences. So it's been really great. Like we've both gotten students. You would think that, you know, one with the other, but it's just an incredible partnership because we both have gotten the connections with both.
Who is watching these? How are they being used? Are they being used in class or is it just people having some fun at home watching the YouTube videos?
So far, we think it's a combination of those things, and we really just feel like we're getting started. But the idea was to create something that would be useful for teachers and their classes in this very strange school year. We think that's primarily what's happening, but since everyone is home at least part of the week, if not all of it, we feel like it's also getting used a lot in that context. And as we build up more of a library of these, what we're hoping is the teachers will begin to use them as a fun addition to their curriculum and saying, read one of these books, take the challenge yourself, see how you do. And really it all goes back to the same thing we're always all trying to do. And teachers or school librarians and authors are very similar in that they really have the same goal is to make reading fun and get kids excited about reading. And so in the end, that's really all we're trying to do.
I mean, I'll show a video in a class, whether the kids have read the book or not, and then the wait list for that book will now become 10 deep. So even if students haven't read the book, it still gets them excited because they see another student excited about the book. And then the other great thing is just the opportunity that these students have to meet their favorite author. I think, you know, yesterday was for the first time, it really became so real to me because it was a former student of mine and I knew that he loved this author and Steve was able to get the author and I was able to get the student. And then I got all weepy because I had this opportunity, even if it's on Zoom, it still feels real. Like we feel like they're together and they're meeting this author and having this conversation and able to have a back and forth with the author who they have loved for so many years in person, so to speak. So what an experience for the students.
Are you getting support from your school district? Are they saying, hey, this is a great idea? Let's, are they supportive, I guess, is the question.
They just posted it on the school website. We had an article written in School Library Journal. I think this is an after school project. So this is, they're certainly supportive. They certainly are thrilled to see their students as any, I think all districts who have their students highlighted. I have a colleague in Alabama whose student was on our show, and their district took the ball and ran with it and just really was thrilled to have their student participate. So I think all districts are, again, you know, we want to make reading fun. We want to show that how great reading is, support reading, and this is one of the ways that we can do that.
Steve, is this a big substitute for author visits and book signings?
That's a bit of it. Yeah. I mean, and again, everything shut down so quickly last spring, including all of my travel. And so, yeah, that is definitely part of it. I miss going into the classrooms, meeting with kids, sharing ideas, getting their feedback, but also meeting colleagues. It's a pretty lonely job most days. Writers go into that knowing that they're usually introverts anyway, so they're okay with that. But I sort of counted on those a quarter of the time being out and about and meeting people. Now I don't do that at all. And I think that was part of the motivation. It's really fun to see friends, even if it's just in this format, which is, you know, what everyone's doing this year.
So which one of you comes up with the questions?
That's very 50-50. We usually, we decided early on that we both would read the books beforehand. No shortcuts. In other words, at first I thought, I'll just look online and maybe there'll be a bunch of questions, you know, and some books have them because teachers have, you know, they're generous and they post activities online. But we realized quickly that was kind of a cheat, that we better both read the book and each prepare. You know, we only come up with 10 or 11 or 12. So each prepare a bunch of questions and put them together on a sheet. I think it's important that we both, don't you, Stacey, that we both do that together?
Yeah, I think, and I love, you know, this is, it's just the way it's evolved and how organic this sort of relationship is. I mean, Steve and I were friendly, but now we are just a really great partnership and collaboration. And so depending on who finishes the book first, will be the one to sort of put the questions in the template. And then we're both like, I came up with most of those too, you know, that they're the same, similar questions, or maybe, you know, maybe this one is too easy, or maybe we should add in. It's a beautiful partnership.
I know when I interview authors, and I do a lot, I try to find some little obscure part of the book and just ask a question about that. Is that what you try to do, especially if you're coming up with one where you want to stump the author?
Yes. Yeah, usually by question 8, 9, 10, we want to find things. We will find things that happen just once. It could be a dog's name or a detail from a classroom the character is in, or something very small. We love to pull things from history. Yesterday we had a historical novel set in World War II, so pull little facts from history that come up in the book. And yeah, they should get harder, and we definitely want to stump them, especially the author.
Given the situation with the pandemic and everything, where do you see the role of the school librarian in all this?
We're still here. We're still kicking. We're still strong. I think we're, as we have always been, supporting teachers, collaborating with teachers, and supporting and promoting reading and research. And we are still doing that as strong as ever. We are working. I'm on a cart and I don't have students in the library. And I know, you know, and across the country, some people have students in the library, others don't. We're all quarantining our books, but we are still there for our students, and we will be there after the pandemic as well.
I spoke to someone earlier this year who called the school librarian the school's chief information officer.
I should have used this as I introduced myself, but and Steve will always say that I am the leaping librarian. And I think that, you know, I see us as the rainbows and cupcakes and unicorns of the school. You know, I make the kids smile. I bring joy to their lives, whether it's whatever we are doing or the books that I'm giving out. I mean, they're getting, it's actually unbelievable to me because I will pack up books and give them in their little bags and they're so excited. It's like Christmas every day when they're opening up their books to take home and they're not able to browse in my library. So they have to fill out a form and I do the best that I can in terms of getting the books that they request in their hands.
So how long can this game show career continue?
Who knows? We started it as a lark. Then it became so easy. This is the shocking part. It got so easy to book really great authors that we went crazy and started doing two a week. Then we realized, wait a minute, we actually have jobs. So let's do one a week. That's what we're doing now. We post them every Monday morning and certainly through the school year. We're almost booked up through the school year. So certainly through this year, at least.
Who knows? We have no idea. And I just love it so much. You know, going to school, I love my job. It's hard during these times now. And so I look forward to our Mondays when we're recording, our Monday mornings when the videos go out in the world. And yeah, who knows? We have no idea where it will go.
Stacy Ratner is a school librarian at Castleton Elementary School in Castleton, New York. Steve Scheinken is a Newbery Award-winning children's author. His latest book is Born to Fly, the first women's air race across America. You can find the author fan face-off on Steve's YouTube page, and we'll put a link up on the Best of Our Knowledge page at WAMC.org. Got any questions or comments about the Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the Programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC Radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. As the spring semester gets underway in colleges and universities across the country, we're getting reminders of what became one of the first super spreader events of last year, spring break. Last year, we all saw the pictures of college students packing beaches and other tourist spots with no thought of social distancing, let alone masks. The result, a surge of coronavirus cases that they shared when they returned to class. That led to timely research by researchers at Ball State University and Vanderbilt University called College Student Contribution to Local COVID-19 Spread, Evidence from University Spring Break Timing. Last spring, Bob Barrett spoke about that research with Dr. Paul Niekamp, an assistant professor of economics in the Miller College of Business at Ball State.
So in early March, there was one news release that really caught my eye, which was a student who was interviewed by CBS News and responded on air, "If I get corona, I get corona. At the end of the day, I'm not going to let it stop me from partying." So this was a student who was on spring break, and news agencies across the U.S. and even internationally were worried about what would happen if these students go on spring break and they come back to the universities, and what kind of impact would they have on the evolution of COVID-19 spread in the United States. So I saw this, and I thought, well, this is something that I can research. Like, this is something that my co-author and I, co-author is Daniel Mangrum from Vanderbilt University, and this is something that we could research. So we went about and we collected spring break dates from over 1,300 traditional four-year universities. And with these dates, we could look at which of these universities actually had their spring breaks and which ones effectively had theirs canceled. Because around March 10th, most universities had to cancel their spring breaks because most of them canceled their in-person classes. So you had some universities where students could go in spring break and some universities where students could not. And using some statistical procedures, we were able to estimate the causal effect of students going on spring break on COVID-19 spread in their local counties. You know, these university spring breaks, they're determined years in advance by academic calendars. So you have some schools that have very early spring breaks. So students went on spring break, they came back to the university, stayed for a few days, maybe a couple weeks at some of the earliest, and then they went home. And then you had some who went on spring break and found out that their in-person classes were canceled, And then they went to their true home, not back to the university home. And then, you had some students who just had their in-person classes canceled and they didn't get to go in spring break and they just went home. So what we found was that, hopefully this isn't too surprising, but it is in line with maybe people's expectations that, yes, students who went on spring break did indeed bring coronavirus back to their local counties. So students went on spring break, they came back, and then either they tested positive, so we find a bump up, an increase in COVID-19 spread growth rates the week that they return, and then we also find a lagged increase over the next couple weeks. So we see an increase, first a primary increase in COVID-19 spread, so that would be the students themselves testing positive, but there's also that extra impact of these students passing on COVID-19 to potentially high-risk individuals. And this is important because this is something that we've seen, which is that we have these young individuals who themselves are very low risk of mortality. But people are really concerned about who do these students pass COVID-19 to? So when they come back to the county or their university, they have the potential to pass COVID-19 on to older individuals in their social network or to older professors. So you have high risk individuals that are particularly important to study. So we also look at COVID-19 related mortality, and we do find a lagged increase or evidence of a lagged increase in COVID-19 mortality 4 to 5 weeks after these students return. I think it's important to say that spring break and university student travel does contribute to local COVID-19 spread in the counties of universities. And this is something that universities need to take into consideration, that they might have low-risk students who might not be harmed too much themselves by COVID-19, by being infected, but these students do have the possibility of passing on COVID-19 to higher-risk individuals.
You also made a distinction in the study, I believe, between schools that had early spring breaks and later spring breaks, right?
Yes. So that's actually how we identify our effects. So we have the early spring break universities. These students were able to go in spring break, and then they came and returned. And then our comparison group, our counterfactual group, would be the late spring breaks, because these students were not able to go in spring break because their universities canceled classes. So either did not go in spring break, or they went on spring break, but they returned to their actual home, not to the county of their college campus. What we did find was that by April 30th, early spring break counties or counties with early spring break universities had 20% higher confirmed cases per capita than late spring break counties. So we can say that these early university spring breaks and spring break did contribute significantly to COVID-19 spread in the United States.
Does this data tell us anything about the way, anything that we didn't know already about the way that this disease is transmitted?
So I think this would confirm the ways in which we think this disease is transmitted. So there are many ways in which people think it's transmitted. One would be via breathing, or essentially a aerosolization, or I don't want to get too scientific, but essentially breathing in, being in contact with other individuals. Others would be touch and transmission. But this doesn't get that refined in those transfer mechanisms. But this would very much back up just increased social interaction. So abstracting a little bit, bigger picture, we know that more social interaction leads to higher risk for COVID-19 spread. And this is exactly what spring breaks and all these university students are doing. They're gathering in highly congested areas. So if you think about your stereotypical picture of spring break, you have students who might travel to Florida and they get jam-packed on beaches, or maybe they go to bars afterwards. And this would confirm a rising concern, which would be the high congestion of adolescents or younger Americans in bars across the U.S., which has led to either the closure or banning of large gatherings, or leading to capacity restrictions on bars and restaurants across the United States. So this would confirm that as one of the mechanisms. Also, increased travel. We know that the more individuals travel, the higher risk you become of transmitting or becoming infected yourself. Our SafeGraph data allowed us to trace individuals over time as they travel on spring break, and we're able to see which students fly to their spring break destinations versus other mechanisms of travel like driving. And we actually find that individuals or universities with larger percentage of students who flew to their spring break destination contributed more to COVID-19 spread, which should not be too surprising, because if you're flying while you're going through an airport, you're then on an airplane, you're going to, a further away destination. And these people are contributing more to COVID-19 spread.
Paul Niekamp, an assistant professor of economics in the Miller College of Business at Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana. Are artists just a little bit on the crazy side? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Are highly creative people more prone to madness? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Mark Canada, professor of English at Indiana University Kokomo, explores the brain to find out.
Artists have long been considered, different. Writers, painters, and musicians tend to awe, even unnerve us. Some of these creative types have embraced this image of the eccentric outsider. After all, as Emily Dickinson put it, much madness is divinest sense. Is there something different about artists? Modern science allows us to go beyond our impressions and identify possible factors that distinguish highly creative people. In my research on that most outré of artists, Edgar Allan Poe, I have used the modern model of the divided brain to explain his method and effect on readers. Poe showed a remarkable predilection for functions and inclinations associated with the right sides of our brains. The Pit and the Pendulum, The Mask of the Red Death, and other works teem with striking, often surreal images, as well as appeals to negative emotions, particularly horror and grief. Some portray characters sabotaging themselves, much as Poe did in his own life, when he picked fights and blew opportunities. In light of these parallels, I believe that Poe's right brain played a crucial role in his life and literature. Poe, who wrote of the poetical portion of his brain and claimed to have drawn literary material from his dreams, discovered a way to reach our right brains by mining and employing his own. Perhaps artists are not mad after all. Maybe they are the ones in their right minds.
That was Mark Canada of Indiana University Kokomo. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the Programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Ray Graff, in for Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge. Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.